Hello, and welcome to Listen Up, the E3 Diagnostics Podcast. I'm Susan Robbins. My guests today are Drs. Gail Whitelaw and Michelle Petrek. We're going to discuss traumatic brain injury, what it is, how it impacts the auditory and vestibular systems, and how healthcare practitioners can team up to diagnose and treat patients. Welcome to the podcast, Gail and Michelle. Please tell us a little about your backgrounds and your current responsibilities. Let's start with Michelle.
All right. Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Michelle Petrak. I am a clinical audiologist specializing in vestibular testing at Northwest Speech and Hearing in Chicago. And I'm also the director of clinical audiology for Interacoustics. So I have this great opportunity to be involved in both clinical assessments for dizzy patients and also play a role in product development for new vestibular products.
Hi, this is Gail Whitelaw, and I am a clinical audiologist and an associate professor at The Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio, where I get to do a little bit of everything. I teach, I get to do clinical work, and I get to precept students. I'm fortunate to be in a city with a strong healthcare community and have the opportunity to work with many children and adults who have traumatic brain injuries.
So let's start off with, what is traumatic brain injury? How does it occur?
According to the Centers for Disease Control, in a study that was published in 2020, a TBI, or traumatic brain injury, is caused by a bump, a blow, or a jolt to the head that disrupts the normal function of the brain. A TBI can be classified as mild, which is a brief change in mental status or consciousness. A lot of people think you have to be knocked unconscious and you have to end up in a emergency room, and people have heard about the Glasgow scale of coma. Those things aren't necessary. I always jokingly tell our students that the melon that we have sitting on top of our neck doesn't protect our head very well, so it doesn't take very much. And they can have, all of this can have a long-term effect on the life of a patient, despite the classification of mild. Most TBIs that happen each year are considered to be mild, and oftentimes they're more commonly referred to as concussions.
Okay, so now we have a really good idea of really the range of what TBIs are. And Michelle, can you talk a little bit about some of the causes of TBI?
Sure. Most of the work that I've done on traumatic brain injury has been related to concussions and sports injuries. But we know that TBI causes can range from many things: combat injuries, head injuries from a car accident, a slip and a fall, being near or involved in an explosion, and of course, many, many different kinds of sports injuries. So there are a lot of causes or conditions or situations that you can be in that can lead to a traumatic brain injury.
Now, when we were preparing for this episode, you each shared your perspectives, vestibular and auditory. So let's start back with Michelle. You usually diagnose and treat the vestibular consequences of TBI. Can you tell us about what you've seen and how you treat patients?
Yeah, well, again, most of my research and work so far, at least in this area, has been with sports-related concussions. So our most recent work that we did was a pilot study with Banner Concussion Center, which is in Phoenix, Arizona, where we found that it's really very quick and super easy to differentiate someone with a concussion from a normal population simply by counting the number of errors that they make when they perform an anti-saccade task. An anti-saccade task, a little bit different from the traditional saccade that we're used to. In an anti-saccade task, the patient is asked to look away from the target that's presented instead of looking at the new target. So this is a little bit more challenging, right? It throws in a cognitive function that they have to do. So that when they look away from the target, there's this cognitive component that's involved. And this is where we see the concussed patients really start to struggle. So normal patients, normal healthy patients, they can do this 100 times in a row and they're just fine. But with a concussed patient, sometimes they can't get through the first 20 jumps. And then the jumps that they do start to perform, we start to see a lot of errors. So we see them making a lot of mistakes or errors because they suffer not only from an ocular motor deficiency, but also from a cognitive deficiency, right? So these ocular motor tests, especially now, and you'll start to hear more and more about it, especially now this anti-saccade test where you count these errors and add this cognitive component, super easy and very efficient ways to measure, diagnose, and monitor concussion. And another sports-related injury, something a little bit different. So I work with the Special Olympics here in Chicago, Special Olympics coach. And so I work with a lot of these athletes. And just recently, not this year because of the COVID, but last year when we had the Special Olympics, so I saw this young athlete who had some difficulties in performing his activities, standing long jump. So he was post-injury, and so I was able to monitor this over time and document and watch him make his improvements. So I'll give you a little short of what happened. So we have a practice a couple of days before the meets, and we come in for the practice, and this athlete has a fall during one of his practices. He bumps his head. It doesn't seem like anything serious. There's no bleeding, no stitches, anything like that. So he gets sent home. He has a checkup by his family doctor. The doctor says he's fine. Now 2 days go by, and then he shows up 2 days later for the track meet. Again, he does the standing long jump. And granted, these are special needs kids or special needs adults, but they're all very aware of what their normal is and what they're capable of doing, right? So he gets up to the line. He makes his three jumps, and none of them are as far as he usually jumps, and he doesn't qualify for the next stage of the Olympic Games. And so he's super upset, right? So he's throwing his hands up in the air and saying, something's wrong. And I believe him. Again, you know, these are athletes, even though they're, you know, in the Special Olympics, they're still athletes, and they still, again, are very well aware of what their norm is. So I took him to the vestibular clinic, and we ran some tests. So I ran V-HIT, static balance platform tests, some dynamic visual acuity. And sure enough, his scores are all lower than his baseline scores. And yes, all of these Special Olympics athletes have had baseline testing, just as all of the other high school athletes around the area. So I can see right away from comparing his today test to his baseline test that something actually is wrong. And so then we started to do some rehab exercises, and we worked on his static balance platform, and you know, his scores come back to where they were at baseline. And so this documents to us that he actually did have a concussion from that bump on the head that, you know, that he got during his practice exercises. And so after his rehab and doing some VOR exercises and things like that, he goes back to the standing long jump, and he jumps, and he's back to his normal jump length, right? So just a super, you know, easy, clear-cut story of how for these athletes, you really have to have some tests to document it, right? Because the family doctor didn't see anything, but his specific balance and vestibular tests did show that there were some balance issues related to the concussion. And very, very important to remember that these tests will only work if they had a baseline test, right? So you can't bring in an athlete after an injury and do a test and expect to see an abnormality if you didn't have a baseline result to compare it to. So the take-home message there is that all of these tests do pick up concussions, and that these athletes should have baseline testing beforehand so that we can make these post-injury assessments.
That's really interesting, and I think that, you know, we're much more used to hearing about vestibular issues related to a traumatic brain injury. And Gail, you focus on the way brain injury affects auditory processing and communication. Can you please explain?
Sure. First of all, I love Michelle's story because it's a quality of life issue. And I think that for people who have traumatic brain injuries, audiologists have such a significant role on a team of looking at how do we improve people's functional communication and overall their quality of life. Many people who have mild TBI have little care after their incident. They may have not even gone to an emergency room. And if they did, they got a quick once over and were discharged from the hospital very quickly. They often are discharged within hours of the accident, which I think most people aren't aware of. The concept of post-concussive syndrome, in the literature you see that referred to as PCS, can appear days or weeks after the original incident, and it can last for years. And that's one of the things I think is really important for audiologists to look at, is that we can work with vestibular, but we can also improve functional communication and provide care that's really within our wheelhouse on this team. Most people with post-concussive syndrome will report having tinnitus. Some will report having sound tolerance issues, or what you might call hyperacusis. Some will report what we often traditionally think of as peripheral hearing loss. I think a lot of audiologists were trained in, oh, if you have a head injury, you might have a peripheral hearing loss. And then most importantly, some hearing and listening issues that might be considered to fall in the auditory processing range, most specifically listening when it's a really difficult background situation, listening in noise, listening in a work environment when demands are put on their auditory systems. As we were preparing for this, we talked about a case of mine that I think is probably one of the most remarkable. And as I start this, I don't want people to think, I know better than anybody, because it's easy to be an armchair quarterback and go back and look at a case and say, gee, I wish that they had done this or I wish that they had done that. But I met a patient who had been in the original Boston Marathon bombing. She was in the marathon and she had two head injuries that day. The first, they think, was related to the first bomb going off, where she was almost at the finish line. And the second was when she was pushed down by a police officer to try to protect her from the second bombing. Right afterwards, she described what was chaos. Many of her friends were injured in very, very critical ways, losing limbs. And she did not go back to work. The Boston Marathon happened in April each year. She did not go back to work until almost the beginning of July, this time of the year. She owned her own business and had been basically at home trying to get some recovery for herself. And when she went back to work, she realized very quickly that she was having considerable difficulty doing her job. And her biggest concerns were she could not hear background noise, any kind of competing information really impacted her auditory system. The sad part of her story is that she saw 7 audiologists within a period of a year after this. In each one, she would go in and report, I have trouble listening and background noise. I think I hear sounds okay, but I can't discriminate anymore. I can't go out to a restaurant. I have significant difficulty doing my job. When I sit in a meeting, I can't follow along. All of these were her complaints. Of the 7 audiologists that she saw, not one of her audiologists did a speech and noise test, and that was her main complaint. And she was very frustrated because she had been told by one of the audiologists that she had PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, which last I looked isn't in the wheelhouse of audiology to make that diagnosis, and it had already been made by a psychologist and a psychiatrist. And I don't think it would be surprising to anybody that after what she had gone through that she would have PTSD. She actually lives in Boston and had to go by where the marathon site was and said it was terrifying from time to time because of what she had been through. She happened to meet one of our colleagues at an HLAA meeting, and he called me that night and said, I have a patient that I'd like you to see. She really has had a lot of issues listening in noise, and I know you would not pay attention to that. So I had spoken to her on the phone before she flew to see me, and she said she was going to be very angry if we told her things like one of the ENTs had told her that it was all in her head, that she had perfectly normal hearing because each of the 7 times her audiogram was normal. So she told me she was going to be really mad if she spent money to fly and see me and I was going to say those things. And I tried to assure her that wasn't going to be the case. And the first thing that we did was something so simple, the Quixin. It takes less than a minute to give. And she had a really, really significant signal-to-noise ratio hearing loss. Very quick to identify. And she started to cry in the booth and she said, this is what's wrong with me. And we worked her up for a whole central auditory battery, which demonstrated that she did indeed have central auditory issues. And for anybody who's interested in this, there's so much information out there right now on how to grow a practice related to this, because I'm going to talk about this in a minute, but if you build it, they will come. There's a huge demand among this population. We ended up putting mild gain hearing aids on her. We have a protocol for doing that. And if any of you are interested, just email me and we'll send it to you. A lot of places are starting to do this, like Walter Reed Medical Center, Military Medical Center, and NCRAR are starting to look at some of these kinds of things. And we've been doing it in the lab at our facility also. But this particular patient thought that wearing hearing aids was the biggest miracle for her, and it addressed what she needed and it gave her better signal to noise ratio. And we also found a fantastic speech pathologist for her who worked on compensatory strategies, just as you would if you had a stroke or other kinds of brain injury issues. So her outcome was fantastic. And she was very happy with how the outcome turned out. And it really improved the quality of her life from functional hearing. She was able to go out and socialize with friends again. She was able to do a different job. She sold her part of the company because of many reasons, but it really, really enhanced the quality of her life. And I think that's why we're audiologists, is to be able to support people and do exactly that. So I think it's a really exciting area to work in because of what you can bring to the table.
Both stories are extremely interesting, and what they point out to me is that, as with many other situations, it's really best to take a team approach when diagnosing and treating patients who have these sort of multisystemic injuries. And how have you seen this work with brain injury patients, Gail?
You know, right now, big things in healthcare are interprofessional education, that is, taking our students and educating them with other students, healthcare professionals, and interprofessional practice. ITP is huge. And the research out there says that people have better outcomes when we work as a team and we practice in this interdisciplinary manner. And I can say that I've been really excited to get to work with the people that we get to work with. We get referrals and work collaboratively with physical therapists, with a physician group called Physical Medicine and Rehab, or Physiatry, with neurologists, with optometrists, with psychologists. We do some really neat things for people who, maybe after their head injury, especially if they've had a motor vehicle accident, which you'll see in the literature referred to as MVA, they're afraid to drive. There are physical therapists who work with getting people into driving, or driving simulators at many big places like Ohio State and the University of Michigan both have driving simulators as part of what they do. And so I think it's a really exciting time to do that. And being able to treat patients in this manner gives them a great synergy. And I'll turn it over to Michelle, because I'm sure she works with interdisciplinary teams also, as she's already mentioned.
Well, yes, thank you, Gail. And your story was very, very moving. So thank you for sharing. So our vestibular, we're a private practice audiology clinic, you know, in my situation. And so for a long time, it was really just us, working amongst ourselves, maybe with the ENT doctor, maybe with the local physical therapist, and that was about it. And then just recently, and sad to say, it really hasn't been that long, but, you know, just recently, the last couple of years, we've learned that that wasn't enough for us to handle our not only traumatic brain injury, but also, like, progressive central disorders. It wasn't enough. So, you know, now we have an optometrist that is on our, at least on our once a month meetings, where we do case reviews once a month, but we now include ophthalmologists because we know that eyesight's important to balance. And we have occupational therapists that can help these patients learn how to, you know, handle things when they get home. So we also have an occupational therapist. We bring in the family members, and, you know, this is on top of our traditional physical therapy and audiology. And then, of course, after hearing Gail's story, you know, we've even come to realize that maybe even just within our audiology practice, we're not doing enough. When we see patients for vestibular for audiology, we do a hearing test, of course, and we do an impedance test, and then we take them right on back to the V&G room where we start doing all the vestibular tests, but never, ever, ever have we run speech and noise testing just as a routine. So we're even fortunately growing amongst what we do in our audiology practice, as well as bringing in all of these other multidisciplinary folks that we need to make this complete diagnosis. And we know that no two patients are ever going to be the same, and that there's no, you know, no one program that will fit everybody. Everybody's program for recovery has to be individual, you know, to develop based on their case and develop based on what all of these professionals bring to the table. So definitely a learning lesson, and definitely a multidisciplinary approach.
Michelle and Gail, thank you so much. I think this was a very interesting episode about something that seems to be very straightforward, and it certainly is not. Listeners, if you want to learn more, you can contact your E3 sales representative. You can contact Dr. Petrak at mipk@interacoustics-us.com or Dr. Whitelaw directly at whitelaw.1@osu.edu. thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.